Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lakeen. This week, voters went to the polls in 34 states to elect local and state officials. What happened? And what does it tell us about what might happen in the presidential election next year? Our first guest, Harold Morrison, will join us for election analysis. Following him will be a conversation on the state of our democracy. Harold Morrison is one of the nation's leading political analysts. He is editor-at-large of The American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. He has also been a weekly op-ed columnist for The Washington Post and executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. He is here with us today to share his analysis of the election. Harold Morrison, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what you have to say. So what do you think is the most significant thing that happened in the election this week?
Well, the most significant thing that happened is I'm going to encapsulate the results in any number of elections, is that suburbs, somewhat upscale suburbs and middle-class suburbs that have historically been Republican are turning resolutely Democrat and are getting a very high level of voter participation, which is why Attorney General Beshear appears to have ousted Governor Bevin in Kentucky, which is why one reason why the Democrats now will control the legislature in Virginia, and why the Democrats swept in the historically Republican suburbs of Philadelphia, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a real change there, a kind of anti-Trump revulsion among college-educated Republicans, particularly women, that really pose a problem for Republicans going forward, not that they didn't already have a host of problems. Beyond that, in terrains which are solidly Democratic, big cities, you see the steady movement in their local elections on Tuesday of those cities electing more progressive candidates, often minority candidates in seats that had not been held by minorities. So those are the two takeaways I have, broadly speaking, from Tuesday's elections.
Well, that sounds really promising. And let's talk a little bit more about Virginia, which is near us here. So for a long time, in my mind, a lot of people think of Virginia as a Republican state. It's the headquarters for the National Rifle Association. It's where a lot of the kind of racist activity happened back, you know, many years ago. And yet here we are in the election this Tuesday. Democrats won a majority in both the House and the Senate and the state legislature. How is it that Republican Virginia was won in both houses there by the Democrats?
Well, actually, Virginia statewide has been trending Democratic for a long time. Virginia has five statewide elected officials, the two senators, a governor, the lieutenant governor, and the attorney general. The last time the Republicans won just one of those races was 2009, and they haven't won any since. So at a statewide level, Virginia has been going Democratic, and right now it has before this election, it had a Democratic majority in its U.S. House of Representatives delegation. But basically, Republicans were able to cling to the legislature through the magic of gerrymandering, and they managed to do that in the last decennial census after the 2010 census. What happened this time is two things. First of all, there was a court order that they had to draw new lines for about 11 new districts where the gerrymander was patently racially discriminatory. So that's one reason. The other reason is what I just said, which is that even mm-hmm. historically Republican areas, which are generally middle class and up, started voting Democratic out of revulsion with both with Trump and with, you know, what is still the far right policies of the Virginia Republican Party. So that was part of it. But also in redrawing the lines, to get back to reason number one, districts were more racially diverse. Virginia's had a lot of demographic change, like most areas of the country, and particularly like most areas of the country that are in or near major metropolitan areas, which is certainly what Washington, D.C. is. And as those districts become more racially diverse, and as the Republican Party positions itself more and more as a whites party, as a white nationalist party, that doesn't play well with a lot of voters, not just minority voters, but some moderate white voters who might historically have voted Republican as well. So this was a result that was waiting to happen. And now, with the Democrats in control of the legislature, you will not get a Republican gerrymandered legislature coming out of the 2020 census. So I think the Republican, so statewide, Virginia has not been a Republican state in a while. Now, in terms of the legislature, it's not Republican any longer, and going forward, it will be even less so.
That's very encouraging. So I know a lot of women think that the election of the Democrats in Virginia means that the ERA will pass. What do you think this Democratic control in Virginia means in terms of the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution?
Well, you know, Virginia would become the 38th state to pass it, which is what's required in the Constitution, three-quarters of the states. I don't think there's going to be any opposition to that among the Democrats, so I think it will pass. That, by the way, is according to the Constitution, that requires a vote of the legislature. It doesn't even require, it explicitly does not require a governor's signature, not that the Democratic governor, Ralph Northam, wouldn't sign it. Of course he would. There's an odd legal question to this, because when Congress passed the ERA and sent it to the states, there was a condition attached that it had to be ratified within 7 years. Well, it's not 7 years, it's decades. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, that sounds like it goes to the courts, even if it's passed. And Lord only knows what happens then. But I don't doubt that the legislature will pass it.
Yeah, that's encouraging. And we'll see. I mean, the seven-year limit was put on by Congress. I'm sure the women's groups will challenge that, you know.
Right. So
we'll see where it ends up. And of course, if next year's elections are anything like the elections this week, who knows, maybe we'll have the Democrats in control of everything in Congress next year. So we can always keep our fingers crossed. What do you think about the turnout this time? I mean, usually there's a lot fewer Democrats voting in these local and state elections than vote in the presidential years. How was the turnout this year?
Turnout was way up, particularly in those suburbs that I've mentioned. That certainly was the key in Virginia, and even more, it was the key in Kentucky to the ousting of Republican Governor Bevin. Turnout in the greater Louisville area, the Lexington area, and the parts of the state that are just across the Ohio River from Cincinnati, all of those suburbs, turnout was, you know, double and sometimes triple what it was in the gubernatorial election 4 years ago of 2015, and giving massive support to the Democrat in the suburbs of both Louisville and Lexington, the two cities that we urbanites might recognize as cities in Kentucky, and the three counties that are on the Ohio River that are suburbs of Cincinnati, the Republican Bevin carried all three of those 4 years ago. He lost two of them now on Tuesday in the Lexington and Louisville suburbs. Bashir, the Democrat, won those 4 years ago too, but Bashir won them by like 3-1 margins, huge majorities, whereas the Democrat 4 years ago had basically scraped out just some small majorities. So major increase in turnout, particularly in that constituency, and you know, also in suburbs like Delaware County outside Philadelphia, which has been Republican you know, since 1854, when the Republican Party was founded. Now the Board of Supervisors is entirely comprised of Democrats. You know, again, this is a surge of turnout. Then also, you know, in terms of that other phenomenon that I noted, which is cities shifting leftward, is turnout in some crucial urban elections as well.
Yeah, fascinating. And I've heard something about the Republicans in Kentucky are distraught that a Democrat won the governor's race and that they're actually now trying to already either overturn or take the powers away from the Democrat who's becoming the governor. Do you know anything about that? Like, I know this is what Republicans tried that in North Carolina before, but what do you see happening
there?
Well,
they tried it in Wisconsin and Michigan when they lost the gubernatorial elections there in 2018. In Michigan, the Republican legislature in the lame duck session tried to strip the governor of the incoming Democratic governor of what would be most of her powers, but the outgoing Republican governor, who hadn't lost, he was just term limited out, basically vetoed most of those. In Wisconsin, though, Scott Walker signed them, and you know the Democratic governor Evans has been in court trying to recapture some of his power, some of which he's done, some of which he's not. And in Kentucky, I mean, first of all, Governor Bevin, the ousted Republican, wants a full recount. He says there are irregularities, though he can't specify a single one. Then there's a process by which, if he objects, they can even throw the election to some randomly selected committee of the legislature, which in theory, I suppose, has the power to overturn the popular verdict. I'm kind of on two minds of that. I mean, obviously that would be outrageous, and I think it would just inflame public sentiment in Kentucky and a lot out of Kentucky as well. That might actually put Mitch McConnell, who is, of course, up for re-election next year, in a bit of a bind. I'm trying to think of what would turn Kentucky voters against Mitch McConnell even more than they currently are. That could do it. I'm of two minds here. I'd rather have the Democrats pick up that Senate seat. No offense to Kentucky, at the expense of the governor's seat, since the Senate is really a critical battleground for 2020. But you know, I mean, it's possible. Even if that the scenarios I specified don't happen, that the Republicans will try to do what the Republicans did when they lost the governorship in those Midwestern states. And that kind of stuff goes to the courts, and we'd have to see what happens.
Right. Fascinating. Well, that Senate seat there in Kentucky, as our listeners may know, is held by Mitch McConnell, who is now the majority leader in the Senate and has turned the Senate into what he himself calls the graveyard. All the great legislation that the Democrats in the House pass goes over to the Senate to be voted on, and McConnell is just blocking everything except for he's rushing through as many right-wing Republican judiciary candidates as he can scare up. So it would be a real service to America if Kentucky voted Mitch McConnell out of the Senate next year in the election. What do you think the odds are that McConnell will be pushed out of that Senate seat next year?
Well, I think it's, you know, I think there's, you know, four or five Senate seats that really could swing, and he's not quite on that list, but he's certainly on an expanded list because he's not, the polling shows him to be largely unpopular in the state, but it is generally a heavily Republican state. That's why it occurred to me that, you know, if the Republicans overturn an election and cling to the governorship by that, you know, and that puts McConnell in a really kind of politically tenuous position of either supporting that or opposing that or refusing to take a position on that, that could possibly quite weaken him, his prospects for re-election. But that's merely speculation.
Right, exactly. Well, the sign that the Democrats won the governor's race this time, even with low turnout, we're hoping more turnout by the Democrats even next year. So I'm hoping that maybe we can get rid of Mitch McConnell next November, but we'll see. And actually, even there was another race for governor in Mississippi, and a Democrat didn't win, but did a lot better than people expected, right?
Yeah, it came within about 5 points. It was sort of like a 52.5 to 47.5 election. And this is Mississippi, which, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. hasn't been in play, you know, since the Democrats were, you know, the Dixiecrats were the white Southern segregationist party. So, you know, that's a mild sign of hope as well.
Right. And last year, women mobilized in unprecedented numbers, you know, running for office, voting, donating. Do you think that was kind of a one-time boost in women's political participation, or were women active in this election as well?
Absolutely not. I mean, women, for one thing, if you look at just the polling at any level of income or anything like that, women are far more likely to be voting Democratic, to be appalled by Donald Trump. And certainly there were a lot of women elected in places that hadn't elected women before, or very few of them. Your hometown of Boston put a lot of minority women on the city council, which is a first for Boston. We're just going to see more of that. I mean, you know, Trump has, in his own way, managed, I think, to get women who were not disposed to him to begin with, predisposed to him, to get women more active in politics, and we see that very strongly. I mean, one of the major issues in Virginia was gun control. It was a huge issue working for the Democrats in all of these suburban districts, with Virginia's a state that's seen several mass killings, massacres. They seem to happen almost semi-regularly, and that's a movement that's largely led by women, and that was perhaps the most decisive factor in pushing the Democrats to control of the legislature this week.
Well, that's fascinating. Well, and with that issue and others, you're talking about Trump, also gun control, women are like, you know, this is not going the way we want it to go. We have to take action. I have to take action. I have to run. I have to support someone who I care about. And in fact, it was interesting to me in this election in Virginia that every one of the 100 seats was contested by a Democrat, but the Republicans only fielded about, you know, 72 of the 100 possible seats. So it's kind of you know, more energy, more people running, and then more winning. So it's very encouraging. So how much do you think, I know you've talked about a number of factors, but if you were to read the tea leaves, are we going to beat Trump next year?
I hope so. it's clear, and this is something that Dan Balls wrote, the senior political writer in the Washington Post, that he wrote today, that Trump is going to have to do a massive get-out-the-vote campaign in rural areas and in exurban areas. I mean, he's really got to, anyone who's in the sort of Trump target demographics of the white working class, particularly the white male working class, they're going to have to drag to the polls. You know, and it's a question. Part of the problem is that every Democrat who's sort of in, you know, a major in the top half dozen or so Democratic candidates for president right now, each of them brings his or her own strengths and weaknesses on the electability question, so much so that I honestly have no idea who is going to be the most electable, who is the most electable of those Democrats. Each of them, I can tell you what her or his potential is, and each of them I can tell you what her or his potential downside is. So it's tricky. I don't have any doubt that the Democrats, whoever they nominate, will win the popular vote, just as Hillary Clinton did in 2016. It's the goddamn Electoral College that is at question when you look at the Midwestern states that swung to Trump in 2016. And on the other hand, when you look at states where there's a rising possible Democratic majority, Arizona certainly and possibly Georgia. And, you know, if not in this election, then maybe in the next election, even Texas. So it's you know, let me give you a very informed, I don't know.
That's great. Well, you know, when we were talking about women, you mentioned the women who are just revolted against Trump, even the Republican women, especially college educated, against Trump. But it's interesting, I saw a poll recently showing that the men in the United States kind of split 47-47 for Trump and against Trump, but the women are against Trump by a huge gender gap. I think it's the biggest gender gap I've ever seen in a poll on a presidential candidate. So we can hope that women continue to be concerned about and mad at what Trump and the Republican Party is doing to women and to the country, and stay engaged and keep building on that momentum that came out in a glorious burst of energy on the Women's March the day after inauguration. But I think it's, in some ways, it's largely going to be up to the women whether Trump gets back in or not. Do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the veteran Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg has done a lot of polling in the white working class, and there's a, as it were, Trump has, to use Winston Churchill terms, a soft underbelly there where he could erode, and that's white working class women, you know, who look at things like the separation of little kids from their parents at the border and that kind of thing, and just are revolted, you know. So, obviously. I think for groups like that in particular, whoever the Democrats nominate, they will be targeting white working class women and certainly trying to maximize the turnout of women voters everywhere.
Yeah. Now, I'm wondering, you had mentioned gun control in Virginia as being a major issue in the state, and you would have thought that before, but for the opposite reasons. You would have thought before, a lot of Virginians wanted to have complete unfettered access to their guns. But as you mentioned, there's been a series of mass killings, and now its gun safety has risen to, I think, the top issue for voters in Virginia. That, as you say, the women have led that movement for gun safety. And also, youth have been very big about gun control, particularly after the shooting at Parkland, Florida, with the high school students there mobilizing all over the country for gun safety. What role do you think youth played in the election this week?
Well, I think I actually haven't looked at turnout by age, and I don't think we have exit polling that enables us to look at turnout by age. But there's no question that to the extent that young voters are mobilized, are certainly mobilized on the progressive side, not just on gun control, but on darn near everything. This is, I think, millennials and the Gen Zers, who are younger than the millennials. Every public opinion poll shows that they're probably the leftmost generation this country has seen, arguably since maybe the 1930s. You know, and then, you know, with the same precipitating event that created the 1930s left, the collapse of the economy and the failure, you know, to generate the kind of recovery for a while, at least, that's benefited young people. So there's no question that they're out there. And it's a particular issue in Virginia because the Democratic governor, Ralph Northam, had called a special session of the legislature earlier this year to deal with some gun issues, and the Republicans in control of each house convened the session and then closed him down within 90 minutes without doing anything. So I mean, the Republicans were almost sort of electorally speaking wearing a big "kick me" sign to the electorate, and that's what happened. And you know, while you're talking about Virginia being traditionally a bastion of gun rights and such, well, look, the D.C. suburbs that are just across the river from where I'm sitting right now are not a bastion of gun rights. The huge number of northern transplants and immigrants from all over the world who have come into Virginia are not a bastion of gun rights. The state has changed, and the Republican Party nationally is completely at sea with the demographic changes in the electorate. Their relation to that demographic is they repel it, they repulse it, and this has already happened everywhere, you know, in states that grow more diverse. I mean, when I was a young guy growing up in California, it was the home of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. In 2018, the Democrats elected every House member from Orange County, which was, you know, the birthplace of the New Right, the Goldwater campaign, and the spiritual home of the John Birch Society when I was a kid. So diversity and the intransigence of Republicans on cultural issues and their screwing up on economic issues for a long time, all of that has a price with the electorate, which is why I'm convinced whoever the Democratic presidential nominee is will win the popular vote in 2020. It's the electoral vote that we still aren't sure about.
Right. Well, you mentioned the Republican intransigence on the economy and all the incredible way that they've kind of distorted the economy to favor their wealthy funders, and really very explicitly in the 2017 tax bill that favored the corporations and the very wealthy. And you've said before on this show that the key for Democrats to regaining power is economic populism. We certainly see that in the presidential race with Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and some big, bold plans out there, what to do, take on Wall Street and big business, create jobs, increase wages. Did you see any signs of the Democrats moving for economic populism in the races that were voted on this week?
Well, that wasn't so much an issue in Virginia, but in Kentucky, certainly preserving the Medicaid expansion that was put in place by the Democratic predecessor to the current Republican governor, preserving that and expanding it somewhat was a real issue. Kentucky is, you know, a conservative state, but it's a poor state, and a large number of its citizens, most of whom are white. It doesn't have the demographics of the Deep South. It's got a relatively small percentage of minorities. Need and want their Medicaid, so that's certainly an issue there. And then, you know, when I talked about the Democrats doing well with, you know, left-wing candidates doing well in cities, certainly if you look at the things like the city council elections in Boston or Philadelphia, in Philadelphia there are two seats set aside for the minority party, otherwise it would be all Democratic forever. This year, for the first time, Republicans didn't win them both. They only won one, and the other one went to a member of the Working Families Party, which is an avowedly left-wing party that usually coalesces with the Democrats, on a more progressive economic platform. So, you know, we will see more of this. Certainly, as the Sanders and Warren campaign illustrate, and as their level of support illustrates, there's a lot of support in the Democratic Party, and particularly among young Democrats and among young voters generally, for a kind of sweeping, more egalitarian populist policy.
Right. And, you know, it's exciting to see some of the organizing that's happening on the ground by the DSA, which has surged in membership. The Indivisible Group has chapters in every congressional district. How important do you think those progressive organizations were in bringing out the level of victory the Democrats had in the election this week?
Well, where they had members, it mattered. I mean, certainly, you know, literally with the Working Families Party in Philadelphia, that's only the work of progressive organizations. And as you get into the progressive terrain of cities, that's who's pushing those cities to the left, and that's where organizations like that have most of their strength. On the other hand, something like Indivisible certainly has strength in a lot of places. It's more of a sort of middle class majority female organization, and they matter pretty much everywhere.
Fantastic. Encouraging. Well, that's all the time we have. Harold Morrison, thank you so much for being with us today, and I so appreciate your brilliant analysis.
Well, I appreciate being here, Eleanor. Thank you for doing the show.
Next up is Lucy Alina, candidate trainer with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Lucy Alina, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be on.
Yes, well, you know, you are the candidate trainer for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. For listeners who might not have heard of the group, what is the Progressive Change Campaign Committee?
Yes, absolutely. So I am the National Training Director for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and we're a grassroots progressive organization that endorses a select number of candidates every cycle. And since we were founded in 2009, we've actually raised over $26 million for progressive candidates and committees, all through small dollar contributions. And we actually have over 1 million members nationwide. And so the work that we do is to make sure that our members' voices are heard by their elected officials, and especially in Congress and state legislatures across the country.
That's awesome. And your role within this group is to do the training. So what kind of training do you offer to people who want to run for office?
Yes, we offer a whole host of training opportunities throughout the year. The biggest event that we put on is our national candidate training, which we put on once a year. And we bring together hundreds of progressive candidates from all across the country for 4 days of intense training. So they learn everything from how to look good on television, to find donors, to design websites. And we really work with them to develop a message around progressive economic priorities. But when they go back out to run in their communities, they're running as strong progressives.
Yes, and you just recently had your 4-day candidate training in Washington, D.C., which I was delighted to attend. I was very impressed. And if someone is listening and wants to run for office or knows someone who might, I highly recommend the Progressive Change Campaign Committee National Candidate Training. It was really from soup to nuts, like you said, looking good on TV and helping with the website, get your picture taken, raising money, building your team. You really kind of covered the gamut from soup to nuts on what a candidate needs to do, right?
Yeah, that is the goal. We work very hard to identify progressive candidates who are serious about running in the next year or two. And I think one of the things that sets our training apart is that we're really focused on teaching them how to run and win as progressives, but also giving them all of the tools that they need to actually run successful races. Too often in down ballot races, great progressive candidates are left floundering without the support that they need to run great campaigns.
Right, and for our listeners who might not be familiar with it, down ballot means, you know, not the top of the thing, you know, the key races like president or governor or U.S. senator, but there's thousands and tens of thousands of elected offices all across the country. Really, you know, every year there's some election for some offices, and those are much easier to run and win for. But what you're saying is most of the groups that do trainings focus on, say, congressional candidates, whereas the people who are running more for the state and local have fewer resources to help them. Is that right?
That is absolutely true. When you're running for a state legislative race or a local race like city council, school board, there aren't always the resources that you need. So some of the things that we will provide candidates are a logo done by a professional graphic designer. We'll actually take headshots at the training that they can use in their materials. And we help them get their campaign websites up and running. And the training and support that we provide doesn't just stop as soon as the training is over. We continue to run training webinars throughout the year. We have experts providing fundraising tips. We do endorsements ourselves. We're planning on doing 500 state and local endorsements this cycle alone to really lift up those candidates that are running in those races that we absolutely need to win to take back our country in the Trump era.
That sounds great. And do you work with congressional candidates at all, or are you really kind of focused on the state and local candidates?
We do. We do work with congressional candidates as well. For this particular training, we were really focused on providing support to, as I was saying, down ballot candidates. Earlier this year, we ran a separate training, our advanced candidate training, and brought together a set of 30 congressional and statewide candidates with a tailored curriculum that was better suited for people who are running in races of that magnitude. Because realistically speaking, a campaign when you're running for Congress looks a lot different than a campaign running for school board, not just in terms of resources, but how you actually go about running and winning in the first place.
Well, that's impressive that you're giving that amount of support to people, because I've talked to a lot of these candidates, and many of them have never been involved in a campaign before. So, I mean, not even as a volunteer or helping out, but they said, you know, my country needs me, my community needs me, I'm stepping up, I'm going to run. So the kind of training and support and information and guidance that you give is really invaluable.
Yes, and I think one of the things that really sets our trainings apart is the candidates themselves. I know you're going to be joined by Shelley in a few minutes, so she'll be able to tell her story, but her story is just one of many. Many of these candidates have really personal stakes in political issues that have driven them to run out of necessity. So they've gone from marching in the streets earlier this year to putting their names on the ballot in November to make sure that their voices are actually heard in government. So it's really a new class of candidates. And in my mind, it's really their act of resistance in making the decision to run for office. For example, one of our attendees had brain cancer, and he actually decided to run for office because his member of Congress was threatening to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And you just hear stories like that every single day.
Yeah, it's very powerful what's motivating people to step up now. I'm really inspired as an American to see so many of my fellow Americans really stepping up into leadership roles to try and help our country now. And so you've done two of these national candidate trainings this year already. What would you say were, maybe the top two or three highlights from the candidate training?
Well, I think that one of the biggest highlights to me speaks to what you were just talking about, this idea that more and more people are throwing their hat in the ring and running for office. We ran our first national candidate training in 2015. We had 150 candidates, and we had to work really hard to find those folks. This year, we had 450 spots. We had thousands of candidates apply to attend, and ultimately we filled every single slot with great progressive candidates running all across the country. And so to me, just seeing that level of engagement is incredibly inspiring. I think the biggest highlight hopefully will come on Election Day. Our last national candidate training resulted in 80 winning alumni who now hold elected office, including 35 first-time candidates. So as we scale up, we're going to be seeing more and more of these progressive leaders running and winning and actually serving in office and representing the people.
Well, that's great. I love your focus on results, because that's what we need, is people to win. And that's really,
absolutely.
You know, it's important to run and to carry a message, and it's more important to win so you actually get to implement the programs that you're talking about. So if you had thousands of people applying for 450 seats at this candidate training, how did you decide who was admitted and who got to go in and who didn't? Do you have requirements on where the people stand on issues? Do you have requirements on viability? Or what do you use to sort out the people that you take in?
Yes, that is a good question. Our process for vetting candidates is incredibly time intensive. I think it's probably the biggest lift in terms of putting together an event like this, is doing the vetting of candidates. I think the number one thing we're looking for is that they identify as a progressive, and that they are already a leader in their community, and that they really truly represent working families. We don't have a litmus test in terms of a set of issues that you need to check off, which we do for our endorsements, but we hold off on doing that for this training because we know we have candidates who are running for everything from school board to Congress, and the issues that they're actually going to face once they're serving in office, the issues that they're going to govern on are just drastically different. What we're really looking for is their story. We're excited about candidates like Katie Muth. She is a candidate running for state senate in Pennsylvania in District 44. She's a professor. She's the chair of her local Indivisible group. She founded it and grew it out, and she decided that she was going to run for office to take her passion to that level. And she really has deep personal ties to the issues. So she really is a messenger that's part of the message. Implementing policies to support working women is a central part of her campaign, and it stems from her personal experience. She makes about half of what her husband does in the same occupation, so the gender pay gap is one of the issues that's really high on her priority list. And so this is just one example of one candidate at the training, but we have an application. We do interviews, sometimes multiple interviews with candidates, to really get a sense of who they are, what makes them tick, and do we actually think they have a path to victory and are going to fight for working families, everyday Americans, once they're in office.
Right. That sounds great. Well, that's all very sensible, and you hope they have a path to victory if they're getting in. So what happens now, like, say there's a candidate listener or someone listening now who wants to run or is running? Do you have another training, or you've done two already, so maybe you're done for the year, but when's your next training? And if there's someone who wants to run now, is there any kind of support that you can still offer?
Absolutely. If someone's running for office right now, I would encourage them to go to our website. It's www.boldprogressives.org. And on there, you'll see a button that says candidates. You click there and you can find all of the resources that we're offering to candidates as they move forward in their campaigns. And it ranges from monthly webinars on different topics to train them on the skills they need depending on what part of the cycle they're in. For example, we do a training on getting out the vote about 2 months before Election Day, such that candidates are ready and have wrapped their minds around it as they go into it. We also do endorsements. We'll fundraise on the behalf of candidates that we support. We actually offer software to help candidates design their own campaign websites, and that's something we're particularly proud of. At 3CCC, we're really focused on figuring out ways that we can provide scalable support to candidates who are running all across the country. And unfortunately, this year, we're not going to run another national candidate training. We do only one a year, but we are going to run one in the spring of 2019. And any candidate listening in can go to www.nationalcandidatetraining.com to fill out our application and throw their name in the hat.
Excellent. Well, I'm so happy you're doing this for progressives running for office. And you mentioned one of the most important things you looked for was the story of the person running, because, you know, partly that would mean they're clear about who they are and why they're running, and they're going to be able to communicate that clearly to the voters. What were some of the stories that you heard from the candidates who came to your two trainings this year that really moved and inspired you?
Oh, that is a tough question because there are so many. I'll pick out a couple. First of all, Shelley, who will be on your show in a minute, has an incredible story, and I'm very excited that your listeners are going to get to hear from her. Another candidate that really stuck out in my mind was Cindy Ralston. She's an Oklahoma public school teacher, and she's running for Oklahoma State House after her legislator trivialized the teacher strike that they had there earlier this year. And I think one of the magical things about our training is that it's not just a training, it's also a convergence. We work very hard to have candidates not only develop relationships with us, but to develop relationships with our allies and with other candidates. And one of the kind of magical things that I saw happen at our last national candidate training was we had a set of teachers from Oklahoma and candidates, some of whom were teachers who had participated in the state's wave of strikes. They were meeting in between sessions to talk about what it would look like to create a national organizing force for teacher candidates. We have organizations that do that to promote veterans, but there isn't one right now for teachers, in particular public school teachers. And so those are the kinds of stories that really inspire me.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, I'm so excited you've helped all the people who in your two national trainings already this year, and that you're still open to helping other progressives who are running. I actually have a friend who's running for school board here in Washington, D.C., Emily Gasoy, who's a really great teacher. And I'm going to tell her to get in touch with you all because she's never been in a campaign before, and I'm sure you can help her a lot. So you mentioned the focus more on the kind of the state and local, maybe the smaller races, more so than for Congress. It's interesting to me because it just feels like such a critical moment in our country to elect progressives to Congress as a check and balance on this authoritarian and very dangerous occupant of the White House. So why did you decide to focus on those down-ballot races?
Yes. Well, I'll say first, our advanced candidate training gave us an opportunity to provide some of those resources to congressional candidates. I completely agree with you. We can't stay away from that. I think the reason that we ultimately decided to focus on down ballot candidates is because these folks don't often have the support that they need. But more importantly, yes, of course, we need to take back the House and the Senate. But we also need to invest in taking back state legislatures and building a pipeline of progressive leaders from the ground up. And that work takes years. We need good progressives governing in school boards. We need them on city councils. We need them in state legislatures. And unfortunately, in our national news cycle, you often don't get to see these candidates. But these are the folks who are making real decisions about everyday American lives. And we need good people in those spots. And so with all of this energy surrounding the resistance and all of these people deciding to get off the bench and run for the first time, we wanted to make sure that we were helping these people build the infrastructure that they need to win.
That's fantastic. And so often when someone is running, you know, it's so much better to run for a seat that you actually have a shot at winning. And it's amazing how easy it can be to win a seat in the state legislature. You know, part of what's been happening is candidates, incumbents are in there, and they haven't been challenged in years, even decades. So as soon as the voters have a chance for someone who's an attractive candidate as someone they could vote for, you know, boom, the new person is running and winning. And we've seen it this year in elections, starting really last November in Virginia, and where there were so many first-time people ran and won in the state legislature. It's just, I think, a great time where the wind is under the wings of the people who are bringing new blood, new energy, new ideas into the state races.
Yes, I agree. I think even more importantly, we have this wave of energy, people who are deciding to run for the first time. But I think the other thing that we're seeing is that these people can actually run and win as bold progressives. There's been some debate in the Democratic Party about what candidates to run, and the establishment often supports more centrist Democrats. But what we're seeing is that the economic populist priorities are the way to campaign in these districts. The average American, they don't care about corporate tax credits when they're up and worried about how they're going to pay for their medical treatments at night. So we need to keep pushing our party to represent these everyday Americans. And I think we have a real opportunity to do that in these state, leg, and local races this year.
Right, exactly. Well, what kind of messaging are you encouraging your candidates to carry? As I know, I ran into my friend Linda Lake, who's one of the top pollsters for progressives in the country. I ran into her at your candidate training, and I asked her what she thought, given her knowledge of polling, what she thought it would take for more progressives to win in November. And she said, a focus on economic message. Do you agree with that? And what kind of messaging are you suggesting to your candidates that you're supporting?
Absolutely. Well, first off, I completely agree with Melinda Lake that we need to be focused on economic messaging. To me, the top campaign issues of 2018 are kitchen table economic populist issues. So things like Medicare for All, expanding Medicaid, creating millions of infrastructure jobs through bold investment, expanding Social Security benefits, debt-free college. And I really think that the center of gravity in American politics is shifting to be a more bold, progressive, economic populist message. To us, we often refer to it as the Elizabeth Warren style set of issues, and they're absolutely on the rise. They are considered mainstream now. Many of these issues, like debt-free college, weren't even being talked about just 5 or 6 years ago. And unfortunately, many of the candidates who've come to our national candidate training or we support in other ways have said that they've been encouraged to adopt more moderate positions. But we see through polling of swing districts and data coming from Melinda Lake herself that candidates actually can run and win if they focus on these economic populist issues. So I absolutely agree with her, and I think that's one of the most important things that we want candidates to learn coming out of our training sessions.
That's really great, and it's interesting you call it the Elizabeth Warren style with the focus on the economic messaging. I'm a big supporter of Elizabeth Warren. I actually went back to my home state of Massachusetts to work in her campaign. Proud to say that one out of every five of her votes came out of my Get Out the Vote team. So she's been such a wonderful addition to the conversation politically and to the votes, and what a leader. Talk about economic messaging that we need to hear, and the voting and leadership to stand up for the middle class and working people in Congress. She's been awesome. And I know Senator Warren has spoken very highly of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, of being with her from day one.
Yes, yes. We were definitely all in on day one for Elizabeth Warren, encouraged her to run for Senate in 2012. We actually raised over $1 million through over 70,000 small dollar donations for her race. And we were really proud to do that because we think she is exactly the type of leader we need to see in the Senate. And we invite her back every year to speak at our national candidate training because she does an amazing job of inspiring people to talk about these issues, to rally behind them and use that as their rallying cry.
Right, exactly. And do you think she's going to run for president in 2020?
All bets are off. You'd have to ask her. But I know that we'd be really excited to see that happen.
Yeah. Well, we have races right in front of us now that really command our attention for what the next 6 months we've got. And what kind of impact do you think it's going to have with having so many progressives running for office this year?
Oh, endless. I think one of the statistics that stood out in my mind from our past national candidate training, 70% of the candidates that we had there were running in 2018, and 64% of them were running in districts that Trump won in 2016. And I think part of the reason we're seeing that is these are people who are realizing that their communities need to be changed, and they need new leadership that reflects their values. And I think that come Election Day, we're going to see a lot of these candidates win their races and go on to change and shape policies in their communities to make life better for everyday working families.
Absolutely right. And then the other piece, of course, that matters with the state candidates is we've got the gerrymandering problem where the districts are drawn up in every 10 years, and they're currently drawn up in a way that's heavily favorable to the Republicans. So if we can get more support in the state legislators, get progressives in there, get some progressive governors even, then we'll be able to redraw the districts in a way next time that happens that are more favorable to progressives.
Absolutely. We actually are announcing in the next 24 hours a series of gubernatorial endorsements for that exact reason. I think it's important to have progressive governors serving, especially as we look to redistricting in 2020.
Yep. And have you put your wonderful candidate training onto video at all to make it more available for the, say, the people who couldn't make it to the DC training but still want to learn? Or do you kind of keep that guarded and just have it directed so you make sure it goes to the people who are true progressives?
Well, we don't have it recorded and shared, but not because we want to keep it private. We actually decided to run a monthly webinar series this year to take sections of the trainings that we run at our national candidate training and make them broadly available so that any candidate running anywhere can just sign up and partake. I think the problem that you face with recording the national candidate training and trying to share it that way is that so much of the magic is about who you meet at these trainings and the relationships that you build. And we were incredibly excited to run this training in support and partnership with several other organizations. Our lead partner, Our Revolution, helped provide trainers, candidates, funds, other partners like Planned Parenthood, NARAL, SEIU, NEA, the Sierra Club, I mean, many others. And all of these organizations send representatives to our training so that they have an opportunity to meet the candidates that are running. So unfortunately, some of the magic, you just have to be there in person. But we are looking at expanding in the future. We're considering running a 1,000-person training in 2019 to try to meet the capacity, the demand that we're seeing out there.
That's fantastic. And you're right, it is magic being there. And one of the highlights for me at your candidate training was watching Joel Silberman, who is a real master at communications and media, to do many sessions helping the candidates get on camera, get clear about what they were saying, how to say it succinctly, how to have a presence when you're being interviewed by the media. He was just a master at work, and it was so exciting to watch the people kind of come up a little bit kind of raw material, and then with just a few minutes coaching by Joel Silberman, they became like these master communicators. So I don't know how you would do that on a webinar, but that was just an awesome contribution to your candidates.
Exactly. First of all, Joel Silberman, I cannot sing his praises enough. We are so lucky to have him come back every year to train at our national candidate training. And you're absolutely right. It is hard to capture that style of training. So not only are we really focused on the nuts and bolts, we're also focused on learning by doing. So as you saw in Joel's session, where he invited candidates up to deliver their stump speech, he gives them real-time feedback and has them go again. All of our sessions operate in a similar fashion. So like, for example, our training on earning media endorsements, we actually have candidates fill out an endorsement questionnaire, pair up, and practice answering tough questions as if they were sitting in front of an editorial board. We also have them do things like practice pitch calls to reporters on getting their campaign covered. So we really want them to go back to their campaigns armed with tools and skills that they've had a chance to actually develop. And unfortunately, things like that are hard to teach over a webinar.
Yeah. Well, we could go on. This is amazing. I love the work you're doing, but that's all the time we have. Lucy Alina with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, thank you for being on All Together Now and for all your great work.